Hello and welcome to the Inquiry Teacher podcast. I'm your host, Matt Fletcher. I'm on a personal journey of self-discovery, seeking to uncover the secrets of becoming an inspiring educator. In each episode, I'll be joined by experienced educators who excel in their fields, engaging in conversations that touch on a wide range of topics. We'll explore the strategies, stories, and insights that can help all of us on the path to becoming better educators. But that's not all. We're not just looking at the past, we're also keeping our gaze firmly on the future of education. That's why I'll be sitting down with entrepreneurs from the ever-evolving world of EdTech. Together, we'll delve into innovative solutions and trends that are shaping the classroom of tomorrow. Whether you're a teacher, a student, a parent, or simply passionate about education, then this podcast is for you. So join me on this exciting journey as we unravel the mysteries of teaching and learning. The Inquiry Teacher podcast is here to inspire, inform, and empower you on your own educational quest. In today's episode, I'm joined by none other than Trevor McKenzie, the trailblazing author behind the books Dive Into Inquiry and Inquiry Mindset. Get ready to embark on a thrilling journey into the heart of inquiry-based learning. Trevor unveils the secrets to sparking curiosity, fostering wonder, and crafting vibrant classrooms where students thrive. Stay tuned for actionable strategies, insightful discussions, and a passion for education that will ignite your own curiosity. Okay, hi Trevor. Really excited to welcome you to the podcast. I know that the listeners have been eagerly awaiting this episode, so thanks again for taking the time of your busy schedule to join us.
Thank you. Your schedule's busy too. We're both teachers, right? And so to find time, and then other sides of the globe, so to find sync time to have a chat, I appreciate your flexibility and honestly the invitation to have a chat with you. I've been looking forward to it, Matt. So thanks for hosting the talk.
Yeah, no problem at all. Yeah. So instead of just asking you for a definition of what inquiry-based learning is, and I'm sure you get asked that all the time, would you be able to paint a picture for our listeners of, you know, what's it like inside an inquiry classroom? You know, what does it look like? What does it feel like on any typical day?
Well, I think a broad answer is it looks like a lot of different things, you know, in the inquiry context and teaching from an inquiry stance. There are many structures and frameworks and protocols that allow for not just curiosity in the classroom, but for thinking to bubble up in the classroom and for teachers to observe the learning and observe the thinking and respond accordingly. So I know that's a broad answer. When we get a little bit more specific as to how that diversity could look like and sound like and feel in a classroom setting, gosh, it looks like maybe sometimes students are in rows, sometimes they're in pods, sometimes they're in pairs. Sometimes it's hard to see where the teacher is in the classroom. And some of those structures and frameworks and protocols I referred to, you know, kind of reflect certain underpinnings of inquiry. So in the inquiry setting, we should see evidence of co-designing and co-constructing. So maybe that evidence is in the action of learning. You know, students are working together to solve tasks or problems or explore questions or design parameters of learning. Or maybe that co-designing is evident on the walls of our classroom, you know, co-design success criteria or co-designing essential agreements. And so the underpinning of co-design could look like an action, and it could also look like evidence of the action. And then last, you know, I said questions ever so briefly, but we should see evidence of questioning in the classroom, whether it's the teacher's questions shaping the learning or the scholar's questions framing the learning. So whether it's a questioning routine that's being implemented to capture student curiosities in the form of questions to kind of guide next steps, or perhaps it's a questioning wall or a wonder wall where those questions are obviously evident and transparent. And then we can move them around and map them out in terms of the unit of inquiry. So we should see a lot of different things, shouldn't we, Matt? We shouldn't just see one teacher teaching the same way or in the same manner for too long of an extended period of time. We should see a diversity of moves and tools in that teacher's toolkit in teaching from an inquiry stance.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And particularly the The seating is always changing as well, right? For the different activities or the different groups. I often have students come in and they're always, oh, the seats have changed again on like a weekly basis. But, you know, it depends on the activity, depends on what we want them to do. But I think removing those rows is one of the great ways of being able to get students curious straight away by when they walk into the classroom, if it's slightly different to the previous class.
And it's such a sensible move, but sometimes it's an oft overlooked move by the teacher is to push the desks aside and get kids seated on the floor and talking about their learning and co-designing something together. Or, you know, I really appreciate the work of David Thornburg, and David has designed these four archetypes for flexible seating. And the archetypes reflect learning needs. So whether a student needs to work in independence, alone, in isolation, finding, you know, a quiet setting, or whether they need to be in a collaborative setting, perhaps, where they're working with their peers and it's a little bit more boisterous and robust and communicative, those design principles really have us and the learners, ideally, understanding their learning needs and then designing the learning space to mirror what their learning needs are. So when we talk about flexible learning, it sounds a little messy, I think, from the outside looking in, doesn't it? But there's a lot of intentionality to how the learning space needs to accommodate for the type of learning we hope to have in the inquiry setting.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And getting students curious and, you know, fostering that sense of wonder amongst your students. Are there any like tools or techniques you could give teachers who are interested in getting started into implementing inquiry-based learning? Like how do you ignite that curiosity amongst students?
Yeah, well, I think this is a big first step for teachers who are new to inquiry is the intent of the curiosity should be we need to get our kids curious about the curriculum. We need to look at our standards. We need to look at the outcomes, the objectives, and ask ourselves, how do we create experiences of high contextual relevance and interest to get our kids curious about the curriculum? And in the inquiry setting, this is provocation, isn't it? This is designing something where it's meant to provoke the curiosity as the entry point into the curriculum. And so, gosh, provocation as a repertoire, you know, whether they're picture books, artifacts, gosh, I have a whole closet full of artifacts that I pull out from time to time to get my kids intrigued about something, to get them questioning a concept or questioning a topic or a learning focus. I find provocative images can be so riveting for students. And when we project them up on the screen and make them nice and big and invite students to come over and have a close tuning in to the provocation. Place as provocation, Matt. Oh, gosh. Sometimes when we remove the four walls of the physical classroom and get our kids outside, whether it's nature or in a city or town, walking through, you know, a cityscape, you know, bringing the curriculum to life through local context is a key facet of what provocation, the purpose of provocation serves. And so place as provocation, nature as provocation could be really, really a powerful start point. I would say the majority of schools I support in their inquiry implementational journey, this is something we spend a lot of time designing, our rich and relevant provocation into the curriculum. Some teams will come together and they'll curate provocation and store them in folders, digital folders. So we all have a plethora of provocation we can go and review and consider using. Some of the schools I support have provocation libraries, which sounds like a beautiful thing, but really it's like a provocation room where there are artifacts and we can go in with a bin, so to speak, and check out these artifacts, these materials to bring into our classroom to design a little bit of a provocation station or provocation table. So I would say provocation would be a book to read if such a book existed. It doesn't. But provocation as the means to get our kids curious about the curriculum, it's a deeply important tool in the inquiry teacher's tool belt.
For sure, for sure. What some of the provocations that you've used with your secondary students, are there any that stand out that was really impactful for the students? Because I'm a secondary school teacher. And sometimes when we read about, you know, inquiry-based learning or creating those provocations, a lot of them, you know, talk about getting younger students excited. It's a lot easier to get them excited about things. Is there anything, you know, any provocations that stand out that you've used for your high school students, for instance?
Yeah, you know, recently we engaged in a partner school of mine, a partner school district of mine, engaged in writing thesis statements with students. And how do we get our kids keen and curious about writing thesis statements? And we actually started with the place. We started with the land. We started with nature. And this one teacher and a colleague of mine took the students right out into a parked area, kind of a forested area, and said, kids, we're going to give you 30 minutes to go find something in nature here that really pulls you in, that really, you know, you're interested in or you're curious about, or you find yourself just grounded near something. And in that 30 minutes, we want you to stop and jot and journal. You know, just do some free writing. What do you see? What do you notice? What do you wonder? And to our surprise, when we said go, the students actually ran away and they ran into the forest, Matt. And some kids went right, some went left, some went behind us, some went straight. And they were all fully engaged for a half an hour, right? We were wandering around the space looking for them, you know, checking in on them. And after a half an hour went by, we blew our whistle and they all came back. Some of them came back with a lot more writing than others, but they all had something deeply personally relevant that we took back into the classroom the next day. And we started to kind of mine down what the heart of their writing was and what that topic was, what that focus was, and how we could crack that open and turn it into a thesis statement. So that was the place was provocation, wasn't it? The interest was nature. And, you know, the concept that we were exploring was going to be sustainability, but we started something local first. We started with an experience first. And of course, the writing resulted in, you know, something really, really fantastic in terms of the quality of the writing, because it was so richly relevant as a start point for students. We saw better products of writing when it came down to our assessment of the writing. So something to consider is how can you create not just high interest, but really start from a place of curiosity and then see how that impacts the data that you collect, you know, whether it's a traditional assessment like a writing sample or whatever that data point is. Reflect on when you start with high curiosity, how is that data point different? So experience is provocation, place is provocation. That kind of mirrors that example there, Matt.
Yeah, I love that idea. I think I'll be trying that with my students now that the weather's cooled down a little bit. Yeah, it's really good. I mean, getting them out of the classroom, like you say, is that in itself, you know, gets students curious of where they're going to, or, you know, thinking a little bit differently outside of the four walls that they're in. So yeah, that's a really great tip.
I always hear from teachers the notion of, oh, I don't have time to do that. Like the time that you took to go do that, I don't have that much time to spare. But the time invested in doing that differently resulted in a very different outcome. You know, the quality of writing, the high engagement, the sense of belonging, that return on investment we couldn't have gotten in the way that we were going to do it previously. And so, yes, it's different time, but that different time gets us a different return on investment. So teachers listening, I want them to consider how the investment in time is going to get them something quite different. And hopefully better samples of the data that as a secondary teacher, we have to collect, right? I have to collect writing samples. Let's do something different to see if I could get a different return on investment in terms of the time that I spend in learning with my students.
Yeah, for sure. Just talking about time, Trevor, I think that's one of the, you know, when discussing with colleagues or, you know, other people interested in implementing inquiry-based learning, it seems like time is often a factor that comes up. Like, I don't have time to let students explore. I don't have time to, you know, let them, you know, freely inquire into something. I've got a curriculum to complete, and I've got to finish three or four summatives before the reports are due. How can teachers best, you know, get rid of, you know, that prison of time that they're putting themselves in, and being able to break free and being able to help those students to, you know, to inquire into things that they're passionate about?
Yeah, you know, this is my 23rd year of teaching, and the tension of a lack of time hasn't softened over the years. I continuously feel like, oh, there's not enough in order to get done what I'd like to get done with this group of scholars. But one thing I have refined and become much better at is around learning design and lesson design. And what are those structures and protocols and frameworks that I, you know, design learning with that actually surface really meaningful and productive next steps? And so whether it's rich questioning routines, you know, the inquiry teacher should have a number of questioning routines in their toolkit, or thinking routines, you know, the fantastic work of Ron Richart and Mark Church, you know, the structures provide agency. don't they? It's not free time. It's not an accountable time. It's the structures that we utilize in our lesson design provide spaces for agency. And so I find that the thinking routines or the questioning routines allow for more productivity in terms of the inquiry space and much more opportunity to observe learning and guide my next steps, so they're more productive and, you know, more beneficial for supporting students. And so, you know, gone are the days where I'm engaged in transactionary learning, right, Matt, where I assign something, the students do the work, and then they turn it in for marks. You know, interrupting and breaking up that flow of transactionary learning are these questioning routines and these thinking routines that really allow us to observe our students and learning to guide our next step. So it may sound like there's not enough time, but we're actually using our time much more productively and powerfully when we engage in learning with these structures and routines.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I suppose the next thing I want to talk about, Sally, is, you know, how can a teacher best prepare students for transitioning into an inquiry-based classroom? I mean, you obviously work with schools where you try to instill the inquiry-based learning approach across the school and in all of the classrooms. But we all work in schools or have worked in schools where teachers, you know, are not a fan of the inquiry-based approach, or they have their own beliefs of what should be implemented. So for students who are going in and out of different classrooms with different teaching methodologies or teaching experiences, how can a teacher, you know, get engagement from the student and prepare them on that journey in their classroom?
Yeah, you know, the one thing I look for with schools I support is where they value and how they plan for competency development. You know, what are the, you know, Kath Murdoch calls these inquiry assets. You know, Guy Claxton calls these learning muscles. In the IB, these are the ATLs. You know, developing those competencies, those are the inquiry skills. If we want agency over learning, our students need to flex those muscles ongoingly. And so, despite the teaching methodology, does the school value competency development? And if the school does, then we know we have to teach the student differently to have them flex those competencies. You know, if we want collaborative learners, but they sit in front of Mr. McKenzie who talks at them for 2 hours, that's doing nothing for them developing that skill, that competency of collaboration. If we want curious learners, if we want inquirers, then Mr. McKenzie can't talk at a group for 2 hours. He has to create the conditions for them to be curious about the learning. So something I look for with schools new on their inquiry journey is, do they value and do they plan for competencies? And once they do it, do we actually honor those? Are we actually designing learning where those are going to surface and our students are reflective of those skills, and we're actually helping them understand how they're growing with those skills across time? You know, the IB, for example, has the ATLs, the approaches to learning. That doesn't mean every teacher designs learning where the ATLs are going to bubble up. Sometimes it's just, you know, hoped for that the ATLs will be flexed across a learner's experiences day to day and year to year. But we have to do much better than merely hope for. We actually have to design learning where those skills are going to surface. So I would say that that's a critical piece to this work, isn't it, Matt? If we want agency over learning for our scholars, we actually have to mindfully nurture those skills long term and put our students in learning experiences where they're going to be able to reflect on how those skills are coming along.
Yeah, for sure. And like you say, the hopefulness of just hoping that the kids collaborate together or not, it's not always there, is it, the case? We need to make sure that we are explicitly putting that into our units when we're designing experiences for our learners.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sometimes teachers just think that those skills are implied in everything we do, right? The students are going to come into our buildings and it's implied that they'll find their way with the ATLs or with these competencies. And we could do so much more than merely hoping and implying that these skills are going to occur. We can design lessons and learning opportunities where they are collaborative, or they're engaged in critical thinking, or they are more interrogative with their ideas. So bringing much more mindfulness to competency development in terms of our planning, I think, is a critical piece for not just new schools to inquiry, Matt, but you reference, like, what about teachers who are teaching differently in different classrooms, but in the same darn school? So Mr. McKenzie may teach from an inquiry stance, but Matt doesn't. what happens when my students go to Matt's class? Well, honestly, Matt, I think my students will come to your class with a plethora of skills that allows them to be adaptable in any learning context. If we're developing inquirers, they're coming with a series of learning skills that they could be successful in any learning context, which is essentially the point, isn't it? We want them well prepared for any learning context. And how do we do that? We develop competencies over time.
Okay. Great. And could you give an example of how like you would foster collaboration, the skill or the culture of collaboration within your classroom? Is there any go-to activities or how do you start? How do you get everybody and collaborating effectively?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to poke around a bit here, and I certainly don't want to ruffle any feathers with the listeners. But what I propose is something that has worked in my context, and what I've proposed has worked in schools that I've supported. You know, number one, for collaboration, there needs to be psychological safety. And so initially, I allow my students to choose their groups. I allow them to choose where they sit and who they sit with. And over the first weeks of school, they're finding relationships in which there's trust and there's safety. And there's a mutual respect and hope for productivity in terms of learning. So I know some teachers are going to say, what? I can't have them sitting next to so-and-so. That's not productive. And so we find our safe spaces and our soft spaces in that notion of giving students agency over who they sit with. But psychological safety is imperative to rich collaboration. And then the second piece is we actually crack open what we mean by collaboration. Like, let's co-design that. You know, what are indicators, characteristics of strong collaborators? And so in my classroom, we actually design, you know, an anchor chart of what rich collaborators do. What are the skills of collaboration? You don't just say that I collaborate, check, I did it. There are a number of things that rich collaborators do. And so we co-design that. And then we have that anchor chart up on our wall. It's not just a reminder. It's not just a pretty anchor chart. We actually use that to reflect ongoingly as to how we are becoming stronger collaborators. So in my class, that list, there's about a dozen indicators, Matt. And I'm constantly, every few weeks, asking my students to reflect on that list and talk about which indicators they demonstrate pretty consistently and routinely, and which indicators they can be more mindful of and perhaps grow a little bit more robustly in. And then sometimes I ask them to choose partners or groups that contrast their strengths and their stretches. So I may say I'm really good at active listening, but I'm not really good at organization. Well, Matt says he's really good at organization and not so great at active listening. That would make a great pair, wouldn't it? Because I learned from Matt's strengths. He learns from my strengths. My stretches should be different after I work with Matt. And so something that we do with those indicators of collaboration is we actually have students be mindful of who they're working with and how that's going to help them grow in some of their blind spots or some of their stretch areas. Students do not like being in a collaborative setting if it's not productive. I think that's something teenagers tell me often, right? Is I don't want to be the hardest worker or, you know, putting all the information in a doc and no one else is contributing to the doc. So something we talk about in class is what does it mean to be powerful and productive learners in a collaborative setting? So no one's disappointed and no one's let down and no one's frustrated. We want none of those feelings in learning, do we? We want confidence and competence and belonging. And so talking about those things, those values, those indicators of collaboration really set a common landscape for students. So they see what we mean when we talk about collaboration. And then there are a bunch of different collaborative structures, aren't there, Matt? Like whether it's a really rich give one, get one, you know, that awesome thinking routine where students stand and they're walking through their room and they're connecting and sharing ideas and collaborating, or whether it's just a fishbowl exercise where you sit with one student and you have a group conference where you're asking three or four students common questions and you're all talking together. Whatever the structure is, we have to be sure that if we value collaboration, we're actually providing experiences where our students can be more collaborative, don't we?
Yeah, for sure. And I always try to, you know, to look at that when designing activities or projects. And I think the importance of roles and being able to say, what skills are needed for that particular role. I don't know if we're doing a news report, for example, you know, what skills does a writer need to have? What skills does the researcher need to have? What skills does the presenter need to have? And then try to, you know, find a role that is within them, within a group. And that suddenly lets them then open up to, you know, leaving the safety of the person that they like to sit next to all of the time. You know, it allows them to mingle and to work with others. But it does take time. And I agree that, you know, that psychological safety of, allowing them to sit there, and also for you showing as a teacher that you've, you know, you're trusting them to sit together and you're giving them a chance to work, I think is important from the get-go to allow
and,
that.
And you know, Matt, you know, what kind of culture of learning are we actively nurturing ongoingly as the teacher in the room? You know, are we, you know, nurturing a culture of learning that is safe, that is open-minded, that is flexibly minded and supportive and inclusive of everyone in the room? Like we, the teacher in the room, has such a powerful hand in creating that undercurrent in the classroom, don't we? And yeah. And so what I'm saying is we need to model the model. We need to put words to the learning we hope to see so our students can see that that's something not only of value, but that's the culture of learning in the room. If we value collaboration, then we need to model the model and put our students in collaborative settings. Just as you're referring to, those roles help students not just have some choice, but understand the parameters of which we're going to learn in, which is really helpful for students to feel confident and competent.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's really good advice for the listeners. I think when they're planning in mind about those skills, those ATL skills, or flexing those learning skills, that they will be able to think about them and how can they explicitly teach those skills going forward. What I want to ask is, because I've got you here and I'm intrigued to know how you go about planning a unit. And I'm sure that's a question that a lot of teachers who are listening
all the time.
How do you start? How do you plan that unit of inquiry? Like where do your ideas come from? Obviously you have the curriculum that you need to follow, but how do you shape it and how do you get started for those who are new in wanting to create an inquiry based unit of work?
Yeah, you know, I'll share a couple moves that I make in terms of the planning for inquiry. One is kind of overlapping the swimming pool graphic, the four types of inquiry, right over top of the curriculum, if you will. If you can imagine the curriculum and that swimming pool graphic kind of coming across one another on top of one another. And when we look at the swimming pool graphic, we're talking about, you know, how much agency is occurring across those four types. You know, structured inquiry, there's less agency, it's a teacher-led inquiry. Whereas controlled and guided inquiry, there's more student agency, there's more of a partnership in the learning. And then free inquiry has a lot more agency, doesn't it? Where students have a lot more voice and choice over the parameters of learning. And when we overlay those, when we put the swimming pool graphic on top of our curriculum, we start to look at our curriculum through the lens of, well, what concepts would best be suited in a structured inquiry, a controlled inquiry, a guided inquiry, and so on. You know, there are certain concepts that beautifully align with guided inquiry and don't belong in structured inquiry at all. So that's one thing I do every school year. Depending on what course I'm teaching, I think of what concepts and key concepts would go beautifully in what types of inquiry. And then once I've kind of mapped it out as such, the next step is I plan for curiosity. Like I have to plan for provocation, as I referenced earlier. What's the entry point into that unit where we're going to start local to go global? We're going to start with high relevance and context so students don't say, why am I learning this? What's the purpose of this? It's really clear what the purpose is, and not the target on the wall. It's the contextual relevance. It's not an assessment target is why we're learning it. It's how, why is this of interest to us? Why is this of importance to us? And so we need to design rich provocation towards that unit of inquiry. And then the next piece is, well, we can't have those rich questions that students ask from the provocation die on the floor of the lesson. We need to capture those in a questioning routine. I've referenced this a few times in our conversation, Matt. Questioning routines are imperative. So we just don't have questions on sticky notes. We do something with those questions. We map them out across a closed to open continuum. We map them out in terms of high importance. What questions do we answer first? What questions have depth that are going to be the through line to the unit of inquiry? And in my curriculum planning, if I design my provocation richly and I've really done a good job with that provocation, the questions that surface from my students, I can kind of anticipate where the questions could take us to help me plan that unit of inquiry. So the provocation and the questioning routine are really important steps in terms of how that unit's going to unfold. And then I really love to engage in voice and choice and ownership. I love to ask my students questions about their learning strengths and their stretches. What are the best ways that they'd like to show me their learning, that they'd like to create something to demonstrate their learning? What are the non-negotiables of the curriculum? What do my students have to do? And where is there space for them to do something that they want to do? So there's a certain amount in that unit of study that I want to have some flex to it, don't I? I want to be able to capture student voice and choice and have some of that take shape in the unit in and of itself. So, and then I'm always thinking about assessment, right, Matt? I'm always thinking about how can I provide rich feedback to students to guide their learning? How can I confer with students? What is my assessment intent? What's the end vision for the unit of inquiry? And how can I thin slice towards that end target to provide optimal growth for my students? So I'm always thinking about the formative towards the summative, the process towards the product, just in terms of best supporting my students and differentiating for them. So I know I threw a lot at you there. How did that sound to you, Matt? Was that muddying the waters or was that clarifying?
No, that was definitely clarifying it. I like the idea of, you know, putting over the four types of inquiry over the curriculum and mapping it out that way and seeing, you know, which is going to need that more structured approach if it's a totally new concept or a bit foreign to them, you know, versus, you know, a more free inquiry or controlled inquiry where you can give them that flexibility to be able to use this. That makes a lot of sense to me. What I'd like to ask is, when students are coming up with these questions and they are, as they go through the unit, they're getting more curious and they have these questions. What do you do with them all? Like for teachers, listen, how do you answer them, or how do you celebrate the answers that they might get from it? How do students organize the questions and how do they demonstrate that? Is it in the end product in the assessment? Is that where they're intending to use it?
It could be. At times it could be. And you know, there are a lot of different ways that we capture questions. In fact, my next book, I'm almost done writing it. It will go into editing in about 2 months. It's about high impact questioning routines. And there are about 10 that I've developed that support the capturing of questions, but then the growth of questions, just as what you're asking. What do we do with those questions? You know, one is well, what about a question timeline? You know, imagine in our classroom, Matt, we have a thread or yarn or wire across the ceiling of our class. And as we're engaged in a unit of inquiry and students are asking questions, we actually clothespin those questions right to the line. In chronological order, so beginning of the unit all the way across our class to the end of our unit. And the story those questions tell about the learning that occurred, if you can envision that chronological kind of gathering of questions, it's quite fascinating. Like the start of a unit, there's high interest, but a lot of those questions could be closed. There may be a few open-ended questions, but because students are newer to the learning, they may ask a lot of kind of surface area closed questions. But as we get into the learning a little bit more richly, as we engage in a little bit more provocation, we all of a sudden see their questions begin to blossom, don't we? You know, that middle portion of the unit of inquiry, that middle portion of that thread, that wire along the ceiling of our class, we can actually physically see their questions shift. They may get more jargony, more academic language. They may get a little bit more broad and conceptual in nature. And then eventually, as we get towards the end of the unit of inquiry, what story do the questions tell at the end of the unit? Sometimes students revisit the close-ended questions at the start because they haven't answered those, or they feel like, oh, there's a must-know question I need to answer here before the end of the unit. So that's one way I'd love for us to envision questions changing across time. Then absolutely, you hit it on the head, Matt. Do the questions need to surface in the summative? Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes the questions could shape the summative in and of itself. Mm. We can have a question journal. We can have a question shelf where in class, not all questions will go explored or answered or solved, but that doesn't mean our questions don't hold relevance or importance. I find students will explore questions that we've asked in class on their own time. Isn't that fascinating? They do learning despite it not being worth marks. They explore questions not because they're being told to in class. They explore these questions because there's genuine relevance and interest in their eye and in their mind. And so just because it's not in my summative or our final task doesn't mean it isn't important to the students, which I think is a really kind of natural lens on how we learn, right? We learn not because it's in the assignment. We learn because we're genuinely curious or interested, or we need to know it. And so, you know, sometimes there's space in my courses and in schools I support to have students create the summative, and their questions actually are reflective in the summative, and sometimes there's not, and there's nothing wrong with that. The questions could be explored in other spaces. A lot of my schools use library time actually as a place for us to explore our questions. We actually go down to the library and we sign out our next reading for enjoyment to be something that has been, framed in a question that we asked in class, which is, I think, again, a fantastic way to tie research skills into questions and inquiry, of course. So I suppose there's not a one way to do it, Matt, but there's also not, it doesn't have to show up in our summative, as I think it's something I want all listeners to hear. It's okay if questions are not explored in our summative and they are asked and explored on students' own time as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, great advice. And, I think having that, the classroom environment where, the kids aren't asking, is it formative? Is it summative? Is it summative? For that. So when that language disappears from the classroom, I think it's a more magical learning adventure that we can have together. And it takes time. But, once you see students invested in it, like you say, like researching because they want to, because they have a genuine passion, then I kind of feel like you've unlocked a box there with the students, haven't you? You've enabled them to be curious about anything then in that sense.
Yeah. And the key to that box, in terms of what you're referencing there, Matt, the key to that box of students valuing the learning, is this formative or is this summative? The number of times we've heard that in schools, right, Matt? And the key is, what is the culture of learning that you've been nurturing? You said it takes time. It does take time. It takes consistency and routine and not wavering from that culture in which you are slowly growing with your scholars. And it should be a culture of learning where we don't learn for marks. We learn because it's interesting and it's relevant and it's contextually important. And when we turn the key there, just like you said, everything aligns beautifully. All of a sudden, students are more engaged. They see the relevance, the purpose of the learning. And I think it does take time, but gosh, that's a culture of learning piece, isn't it? If students are saying, is this worth marks? I won't do it unless it's worth marks. That says a lot about the culture of learning in that room. It's very performative. It's very much for the task and not for the learning. And we want to create the culture of which it is about the learning, which is a big ask of teachers. But I think that's our greatest responsibility in the classroom, is to create a learning culture of which aligns to these structures and frameworks and protocols.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more, Trevor. Couldn't agree more. So you mentioned there, you snuck in that you're working on a new book. Is there anything you can tell listeners about what's coming up, or if there's any release dates?
Gladly. Yeah. It's going into editing in a couple months here. Hopefully November 1st is my goal to send it off to the editor. if listeners are familiar with my other publications, it's going to be similar in terms of voice. I'm in the classroom. I teach half time here in Victoria, British Columbia, and the other half time is spent on my authorship and my consultancy in schools around the world. And so listeners can expect a very similar voice in terms of very much implementational strategies. And the focus of this will be questioning routines. I often see teachers engage in rich provocation. They get their kids curious, but then they don't take the time to grab those questions. And harnessing those questions in really mindful ways can have a number of benefits. Number one, it can have students become more competent questioners over time. Like, we want that. We want students asking big questions and knowing the difference between closed-ended questions and open-ended questions and how to plan with questions. And then number two, it creates a greater sense of belonging. When students see that their questions not just matter, but shape the learning, they're much more engaged. They're much more committed to the learning that they're experiencing. So belonging, question competence. And then lastly, in inquiry, we frame the learning around questions and not always teachers' questions. They should be student questions. And so these high impact questioning routines are meant to create that partnership with our students where the questions that they ask slowly over time begin to shape the units of inquiry that we plan for together. I often talk about a gradual release of responsibility over learning, Matt, where the role of the teacher shifts over time. And that gradual release of responsibility over learning, it will shift over time with really good structures and routines. And so we talk about competency development. We also have to talk about questioning routines as a way in which we empower our students in their learning. So I hope it will be out sometime in the spring. you know, there's no rush to get this book out to the world. I'm currently, you know, continuing to workshop these routines in schools I support and get teacher vignettes. You know, every school I support, there's a teacher on campus who is doing a little bit of writing to contribute to the book, which is really exciting to share teacher expertise from schools around the world. And I really can't wait to show new sketch notes and share these routines with everybody. So hopefully in the spring of 2024, Matt.
Okay, great. We'll be looking forward to that. I'm sure all the listeners will be grabbing a copy. Talking about questions, Trevor, I watched you speaking with Kath Murdoch over the weekend, and you had a little question card that you carry, I think, on your lanyard or something like that. What are some of those questions that you keep with you that you use to ask students?
Well, I'll give you two, and I'll share the one that I was talking about with Kath second, and I'll share one that a dear friend, Jessica Vance, created. And I forget the name of her website. It's leadingwithinquiry.com. It's leadingwithinquiry.com, and it's a free resource on her website. You can go to the resources tab and print it off for free. And what's beautiful about this resource is you print it off and you paste it or you tape it to the back of your staff badge. It's a questions badge. And so on my staff lanyard, I've got my staff badge, and you just flip it over now, and there are four or five or six questions that she has created that are just really good reminders to poke students to think more, to reflect more, and to share that thinking with us to guide some next steps. So that's something that I have on the back of my badge. That's something that, even though I'm well-versed in questioning, it's such a nice reminder occasionally just flip over my badge and have a peek. The one that you saw in my live with Kath was actually from a publication called Building Thinking Classrooms in Mathematics. And because we're recording the session, you know, I'll show the book, but I'll also speak to the book ever so briefly. It's a fantastic book for math colleagues, but I have to say the structures in this book are great for any context. Like if you're an ELA teacher, you could see structures in here being highly applicable to your setting. But what's important about the book is that the writer of the book, Peter, really values thinking. He values asking questions that provoke and promote thinking. And he gives 10 questions to ask our students to continue the thinking in the room so they don't close the door and seek us for too much guidance. They continue to do the heavy lifting of the learning. And so one of my schools printed off these questions on little laminated cards, and teachers just keep them in their pockets or on their desks to remind themselves as to what types of questions provoke thinking. So, you know, some questions from Peter are, isn't that interesting? Like a question, like not a statement, isn't that interesting? And then the stop and pause to elicit more student talk. Can you find another way to show your learning? Or can you explain that in a different way? Can you show me how you did that? I love that one, Matt. Can you show me how you did that? Is that always true? So again, putting the student in that critical thinking space as to, oh, is it always true? Is this an opinion or is this fact? Does that make sense? Like explain your thinking so it can make more sense, more clarity. How could you try something else? Is there a different way of doing that? So of course, some of these questions, you can just hear the math teacher asking scholars, but some of them are really, they transcend context, don't they? Here's another great one. Are you asking me or are you telling me? Isn't that a beautiful question? Are you asking me or are you telling me? So, you know, these little question cards can really help in terms of provoke the thinking in the room, but also help us remind ourselves as to how can we continue to get our students sharing their ideas and their thinking with us.
Yeah. I'll link those resources in the show notes for the listeners. I think that'll be very useful for them to keep on top of those questions in the classroom.
Great. Matt, what did you think of the live with Kath? That was such a fantastic conversation and grateful that you tuned in. What did you think of the chat with Kath?
It was brilliant. Yeah, the book looks lovely, doesn't it? It looks great. Yeah, so I will be getting my family who will fly out to China to bring me a copy because unfortunately Amazon can't really get lots of stuff here. So I'll be getting a copy flown in. During Christmas time, I think.
That's great to hear. No, it's a beautiful publication. It's very rare in terms of how it's designed. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And as we know, inquiry can be confusing for teachers. You know, it could be sometimes too theory focused and not practice focused enough. Yeah. And it's just such a great little publication to have us engage in some common conversations with common language. So yeah, when you get a copy, shoot me an email and let me know your thoughts. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think of it. Okay.
Yeah, sure. All right, Trevor, I've got a few questions from the listeners, if that's okay.
Absolutely, lots of fun.
Excited to chuck some in at you. So this one is from Steve, and he's asking, secondary students often face external pressures related to exams and parental expectations for grades. How do you keep them motivated and engaged in the inquiry-based learning process, especially when these external factors come into play?
Yeah, well, part of that is that culture of learning piece where we have to talk about those external examinations and assessments, and those are really important. You know, inquiry doesn't devalue standardized tests, right? Inquiry doesn't not prepare our students for those external examinations. It's not an either or. It is a both and more. And so, you know, a culture of learning piece is really important. And I think what students want to hear is that teachers are best preparing them for success. And so if there's ever a mixed message that, you know, inquiry is this over here and I'm, you know, that test is over there and they're too misaligned, oh God, that's not the message we want to give to scholars at all. We want to show how both are really, really clearly aligned and how the learning is going to prepare them for the assessment. And so a question I have for teachers is, how are you getting your kids curious about the things that they have to know on those assessments? Like, that's an important kind of pivot for us to make is if we have to get our kids ready for something to demonstrate their learning about something, how do we engage in high relevance and curiosity so kids just don't think they need to know it because they're being tested on it? You know, there's a want to know piece here. There's a relevance piece here. And of course, we've said the P word a dozen times in this podcast. It's provocation. How are we engaging our students in provocation to get them curious about those things that they're going to be assessed on some of those larger summatives or standardized tests? When we hit curiosity out of the park, we should see higher achievement. So I just want to be clear here. Curiosity isn't watering down the learning. It's actually impacting achievement dramatically. So the journey, the planning should be, we need to get our kids curious about what it is that they have to do in terms of performance later on. And then I have a big question about formative versus summative, right? Like the more rich our formative practice is, the more rich our feedback, the more we are getting our kids ready for those big summatives, those big assessments. And so although the question was around inquiry and those standardized tests, it's also about formative versus summative. It's how rich are our formatives to get our kids ready for those. Sometimes we try to crack those apart, right? Inquiry from assessment. We really need to bring those together to get a clear understanding as to how we're preparing our students for those assessments. Another piece I want to lift up, Matt, is, you know, for the first, 18 years of my career, I taught in a provincial curriculum here in British Columbia that was, you know, the final exam was worth 40% of my students' overall mark. And so it was never an either or. It was never a, you know, we do this inquiry thing, you know, 4 months of the year, and then the fifth month, I'm going to do a crash course and getting you ready for the test. It was everything we were inquiring into was getting them ready for that massive examination. And so, you know, I've lived experience in getting, you know, senior level students ready for some significant summative assessments. And it's not an either or. It should be a both and more.
Yeah. All right. Well, I hope that explained it for Steve. That was very detailed. Thank you, Trevor, for that. One other question is from Claire, and she's asking, can you provide insights into the role of reflection and self-assessment in inquiry-based learning, specifically for secondary school students? And how does this impact their development as learners from your experience?
Yeah, well, self-assessment can be so powerful, and it can also be so redundant and fruitless. And so, you know, when self-assessment is powerful, it's when it's accurate and it's aligned with teacher assessment, right? So we want students self-assessing and reflecting often, but not, you know, going down the slippery slope of self-assessing inaccurately. And so what we need to do is we need to confer with students as they self-assess. We need to check in. And are they self-assessing accurately here? Are they, as they engage in reflection and self-assessment, does their self-assessment mirror my assessment of their learning? And if we're pretty much aligned, then I know my students are powerful self-assessors. Mm. So creating the conditions where we can kind of look over their shoulders and look for confirmation of their self-assessment, that's a really important piece. Sometimes students self-assess and they're self-assessing inaccurately. You know, a classic example is two stars and a wish. I love that reflective technique, right? Two stars and a wish. Two things I did well and one thing I did poorly that I want to improve or that I wish I could have done better. And oftentimes teachers don't confer on the two stars and a wish. You know, Matt, you could say you did two things beautifully, but actually the teacher in the room would look at those two things and say, ooh, there's actually a lot of room to improve there, Matt. Mm. You know, your self-assessment is a little bit inaccurate. So when we talk about reflection as a form of self-assessment, I love it, but not without the opportunity for us to confer with the self-assessor. What we're talking about there, aren't we, Matt? We're talking about creating assessment-capable kids. Can they self-assess with accuracy and confidence and competence, to the extent of which it kind of puts my role as an assessor in the room in question, doesn't it? And we only get to that rich place of self-assessment if we're constantly conferring and affirming, are they on the right track? In my assessment publication, I write about the assessment compass. And if we can just envision all of our students having a little self-assessment compass, and our job is to kind of make sure that that self-assessment compass is true. It's north is north, it's east is east, and et cetera. And as we confer, we can hold that imagery of a compass in mind as, are we making sure our students are confident and accurate and competent in their self-assessment? Never is there an opportunity where my student self-assessment is, you know, the holy grail of assessment in the room without me conferring with them, right? Mm. I want to make sure that I'm supporting them with my assessment expertise as well as honoring their reflection and self-assessment as we go. Self-assessment is rich as long as it's fruitful in that way. It's confirming the assessment of the learning.
Yeah, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, right? About explicitly teaching those skills as well. We need to be able to teach the students to be able to be able to do that. And like you say, north is north, right? It should be it should be factual, and it should be there to help provide them the answers to their learning and what it is that they're looking at.
Yeah, and you know, a key piece to powerful self-assessment is, have we co-designed the tool or the success criteria with our scholars beforehand? You know, if we co-design those indicators of success to a certain degree, if we've spent some time kind of unpacking exemplars or identifying success criteria towards a task, and then we have students self-assess, their self-assessment is going to be so much more powerful and helpful and meaningful because we've spent time co-designing together. So self-assessment, yes, but self-assessment could be much more powerful if we're developing that co-design with our scholars in an ongoing manner.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. And then I just want to ask you one final question from the listeners, Trevor, if that's okay. So this is from Coco, and she is asking, have you ever experienced students in your classroom whose English ability is quite low? Perhaps they're a second language speaker of English. And how do you adapt your inquiry-based learning activities to include those students? How do you get them involved if perhaps their English isn't high enough in the classroom to access those things?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in my current class right now, I have four students I'm thinking about in one class. And the beautiful thing about inquiry is that there should be many students in the class who feel quite competent with the agency or the parameters of learning. You know, I have those four language learners that need a different Trevor than the other 22 students need. And those other 22 students can be more productive or more responsible with agency over learning. They can be more accountable for their time and that independence as I sit with certain students who need me. And so actually those four students I'm referring to, when I gave them choice and agency to sit with whoever they wanted to in the room, guess who those four students chose to sit beside? They chose to sit beside each other. And I think this is a misconception with language learners, is that we need to pair a language learner next to a native speaker. We need to pair someone who's newer to English, perhaps, with someone who has been speaking English their whole lives. When in fact, that could be really overwhelming for the language learner. Just the sheer, you know, pace of which I speak can be overwhelming to someone learning the language. In fact, when you're learning a new language and you go to a new country and you're overwhelmed with the pace of which the native speakers speak at, the first thing you do is you ask them to slow down. Can you say that again and just slow down a bit? And that's why those four students have found each other, is because the pace of their articulation is similar. The challenges they're facing are also similar. And then the strategies they're utilizing in those challenges that they face are also similar. So when they come together and they choose a group of four to sit with, I'm more able to best support them. I don't have one sitting over on that side of the room and two over here and a fourth over there. They're all together. And the strategies then that I could give them and that we can utilize together are much more differentiated in a mindful way to their specific learning needs. The misconception is I should get those four students to a level of language acquisition that all the other kids in the class are at. And gosh, show me that wizardry. That's not going to happen at all. They actually get a different agentic experience because I'm able to differentiate and personalize to the learner, which is essentially what we want in Inquire, isn't it? It's not everyone at the same place at the same time. It's let's meet our students where they're at and then plan progressively from exactly there towards their next step. So a couple of things I just want to recap in that question. It's such an important question. Number one, in Inquiry, we should have a little bit more independent learners and competent learners, which allows me some time and space to go sit with the students who need me more. And then number two, can they be sitting together to best support one another? Absolutely. The misconception of having an English language learner next to a native speaker is not necessarily going to be productive to the language learner. And then thirdly, I'm more powerfully able to support them with specific differentiated routines and structures. They may need us to engage in a questioning routine a little longer than the rest of the room, which is totally okay. They may not have the same outcome that everyone else has, and that's totally okay because I'm actually meeting them where they're at and planning accordingly with them, like beside them, Matt. That's another piece, is I'm not doing all this planning in isolation without my students. I'm actually doing it sitting beside them at a desk or at a table working with them, which I think, again, when we think of Inquiry and that flexible seating, that's a neat piece to consider in terms of how we can best support the students we work with.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of, you know, inquiry-based learning, isn't it? Is that there is space and scope to allow students to go off if they're more competent to do things. And it really gives you that more personalized learning approach and support for those weaker students of, you know, any skill, really. So
any skill,
it's really important.
And, you know, the structure in which allows me to observe if my students are competent. Like that's a key piece, is it's not an assignment. I don't assign something and see if they do well on it, and that determines if they're ready for more agency. It's let's provide a structure, a thinking routine or a questioning routine, and see how particular students respond. What are those ATLs or those competencies? Where are they? And then are they ready for a little bit more independence? So within the structure comes opportunity to observe and see who needs what from me. And that way I can better support them in their learning needs in the inquiry landscape.
Yeah. Well, Trevor, I think you've provided our listeners with some really, really useful advice. And I will put all of the things we spoke about in the show notes to allow people to dig around and to learn more about the inquiry-based approach. Just before we end our discussion, is there anywhere our listeners can follow you for updates and to explore more of your work?
Yeah, my website, trevormckenzie.com. You know, I'm active on social media, you know, Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn. So find me there. And I have a newsletter that I publish every month or so. So I don't spam emails, but if you want to really be closely connected to opportunities that I engage in, the newsletter is probably the most relevant space to find me. And then on social media, I think Instagram is probably where I'm most active, Matt, you know, sharing a bit of a portfolio of my work. It looks best on Instagram in terms of video content and photographic content and the colleagues that I work with. So I'd say I'm most active on Instagram.
Okay. I'll include all of your accounts as well then in the show notes so people can follow you and hopefully interact more with your amazing work that you keep on doing. And
too
really
kind.
Looking
Thank
forward
you,
to
Matt.
The really looking forward to the new book as well. And that's gonna be great. So hopefully we get a chance to chat again after the book's out. I'm sure you'll be very busy sharing you know, the book content, but hopefully we can get you on again for
please. I'd love to. It's a great chat and really honored to be on your podcast. Thanks for the invitation and thanks for being so flexible and making it work on the tight timelines that we both have. And thanks to all the listeners, Matt. Really appreciate you all.
All right. Thanks again, Trevor. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. Your support is incredibly valuable. If you can like and share this podcast and even subscribe, this will be great and help this podcast grow. For Apple Podcast listeners, leaving a review would mean the world to me. And don't forget, you can explore more resources over at inquiryteacher.com or follow me on social media @MattTFletcher. Have a great day, and thanks for all your support.